it was just amazing that, you know, everyone would get the soup and they go, oh, God bless you. And it was like so touching. And then, and some people, the stockholders would give us a hard time. Others thought it was great. We're doing it. And I remember this one businessman comes by and he goes, wow, Reagan's only been in office 30 days and there's already soup lines in America. And then the homeless people are saying, you know, there's no food for homeless people in Boston. You should do this every day. So that night when we're cleaning up all the equipment, we go, let's all give 2 weeks notice at our jobs and we'll do nothing but collect food, take it to public housing facilities or daycare centers and Rosie's Place, the battered women's shelter and stuff. And then in the afternoons, we'd cook and we would do street theater with meals at Harvard Square or at Park Station or Copley Square, places like that throughout Boston.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome back to Deep Focus. Before we start, I want to apologize for the quality of my video. I am in the city of Salamanca, Spain, where I teach a class once a semester on the history of terrorism at the University of Salamanca. It's an awesome place, awesome city, terrible Wi-Fi coverage. So you've got my apologies. Also, before we start, I want to ask a personal favor. If you would please like, share, and subscribe, that would help us a lot. It triggers the YouTube algorithm and it helps get us more views than we otherwise would. So thanks for even considering doing that. I am particularly proud today to have with us as a guest, Keith McHenry. Keith is a well-known American activist, best known as the founder of the group Food Not Bombs. He also co-founded Homes Not Jails, which we're going to talk about, and contributed to the founding of the Independent Media Center, which is a very important organization for getting independent media and independent voices heard out there. He was born in West Germany, where his father was stationed in the U.S. Army. He then went to school when he graduated from high school. He went to school at Boston University, studying painting and sculpture, something I always wished I had done. But he later took a class in American history that was taught by the great Howard Zinn. They became friends, and Keith and his work with Food Not Bombs is mentioned even in Zinn's A People's History of the United States, one of the most important books that has ever been written about contemporary American history. And in fact, Howard Zinn even wrote the introduction to Keith's first two books. Keith has made a life out of his activism. He's been arrested more than 500 times. Is that right, Keith? 500 times?
I've done 500 days in jail in San Francisco, but I've only been arrested about 150 times.
100 times. Well, Daniel Ellsberg once told me that he had been arrested 185 times, and that was the thing that he was most proud of in his life. Listen, Keith actually faced 25 years to life in prison because of California's stupid and misguided three strikes law. But in 1995, Amnesty International and the United Nations Human Rights Commission went to bat for him. We're going to talk to him about a whole bunch of things, including the current situation in Gaza, the current situation in Mexico, where he happens to be right now, and the future of the carceral state in America. Keith, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. I have chills after you introduced me. I didn't know I did. I was like known to be something.
You are indeed. You know, I have a lot of friends among activists in Washington, D.C. And I'm not a young kid anymore. I'm 61 years old. And most of my friends who are involved in activism tend to be in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. And they include, you know, nuns who have chained themselves to the fences at American military bases, or who threw paint on nuclear missiles and really cool stuff that I wish I had had the guts to do, but never got around to do it. So I want to start by asking you, how you got involved in activism. Was it Howard Zinn that was one of the motivating factors in your life? And can you take us back to those days when you were in college and you met Howard Zinn?
Well, actually, I think one of the thing that propelled me to be an activist was that I was blessed when one of my grandfathers happened to live with the Hopi in Arizona, before the Peabody Coal and the power lines and the, and I got to the honor of seeing the canyons before they flooded Lake Powell. Wow. And I went to the snake dances for several, like three seasons. So I saw I was such an amazing place. It was sacred. And then I know that when I was a teenager at about 16, I was on top of a mountain in Utah, and I saw the smoke filling the valleys below me from Peabody, from the coal power plants in the Hopi land. And I dedicated to the site that that's any political or economic system that would disgrace, desecrate the sacred land was a system I would spend my life dedicated to stopping. So that was my first inspiration. And then finally, at one point, I took American History 101 with Howard Zinn, and I was hanging out in his collective. There was a bunch of us people in the Hedge School, and so I was involved in that at Boston University. And then I was studying painting, and they sent us out to Newbury Street in Boston to see how art galleries and stuff. And it was just horrible. So then one day at lunch, at my lunch break, I was I was one of two people that ran the Old South Meeting House, which is where the Boston Tea Party started. And I went to lunch at the Commons, and this older lady was standing on a milk crate talking about nuclear war and everything. And I thought, I'm just going to dedicate my art to fighting nuclear war. But the other thing that inspired me was that my other grandfather was in the Office of Strategic Services, and he was responsible, according to Daniel Ellsberg, led the most deadly bombing campaign in world history called Operation Meeting House, where he firebombed Tokyo. And he had painting photos that he took, 63 of them, hanging on his den in Needham, Massachusetts, of the outcome of the firebombing. And I watched him argue on the phone with his friend Curtis LeMay and Robert McNamara, who at the time was Secretary of Defense, for the idea of dropping an atomic bomb on Hanoi to send a message to the communists. So those things really were a lot of why I ended up spending my life as an activist.
Good grief. The OSS, of course, being the predecessor organization to the CIA. That's an incredible story. I didn't know that. You actually come from a very long line of patriots. You have a great, great, great grandfather who signed the Constitution of the United States, right?
Yes. And he was on Washington's staff during the Revolutionary War. He met Washington when he set up a field hospital in Cambridgeport when he was the same age I was when I started Food Not Bombs. And he was 22. I was 22. And he met Washington there. And then he was on his staff through the Revolutionary War until he was assigned to Lafayette. He was at the surrender by Cornwallis at Yorktown. He then was in the Continental Congress, helped write the U.S. Constitution, signed it. And then he became Secretary of War under Washington and under Adams. And he's the founder of the U.S. military.
Absolutely incredible. And then when you were 22, as you said, you founded Food Not Bombs. What was it that got you involved in the issues around food and food security, hunger, and basically serving the neediest people in the country?
Well, I was a produce worker at Bread and Circus in Central Square, about, maybe 2 miles from where Dr. James McHenry had built my field hospital. And I was throwing away all this produce. And I thought, this is terrible. There's public housing about 3-4 blocks away on Portland Ave. So I start taking the food to these people. It was mothers with lots of little kids running around, and it was a lot of fun. And then I'd go to school and do painting or go to Howard Zinn's class or whatever it was. And then one day the mothers were like, they just opened this new building across the street. They're designing nuclear weapons. And that's where I got the idea of called Draper Lab. And Draper Lab actually had been at MIT for many, many years, but they had built this huge building near the what's now called Tech Square. So that's where I got the name Food Not Bombs, the idea of that. But then I was also very involved in Clamshell Alliance and the Coalition for Direct Action Against Seabrook Nuclear Power Station. And Three Mile Island happens, the meltdown in York, outside of York, Pennsylvania. And so I went up to several big protests up there, including, and ones that Howard Zinn had gone to, and ones that I'd, because Howard Zinn had been arrested up at Seabrook protesting there as well. And so I, a friend of mine, Brian Feigenbaum, was arrested, and we needed to bail him out. So we found somebody with some money. We bailed him out. And on the way home, we thought, we've got to raise money to pay this dear man back. And so we thought, why don't we do bake sales? So we're doing these bake sales at Harvard Square and the Boston Commons, and we never make any money. And BU Law, Brian was a law student, and we never made any money. But we also had this old van. And so we had a moving company called Smooth Move. So we're moving this family, and they had this poster that said, wouldn't it be a beautiful day if the schools had all the money they needed and the Air Force had to hold a bake sale to buy a bomber. So we went to the Army-Navy surplus store, bought uniforms, went out and with our baked goods with the sign mounted on cardboard, and we told people we were trying to buy a bomber, and they'd laugh and they'd talk to us and read our literature against nuclear arms race and the nuclear power. We thought, well, that works really good. We didn't really make much more money. We actually had to pay them back from the moving jobs. But we then thought, well, this kind of thing is great way to get attention. And the Bank of Boston was investing in both the nuclear industry, both weapons and in nuclear power. So the board of directors meeting was at the Federal Reserve Bank across from South Station. And we thought, why don't we dress up as hobos? We'll bring out some soup. And we'll say the policies of this bank could lead to a future where people would have to stand in line to get meals at a soup kitchen. And the night before, we realized we had not organized enough people to dress up as Depression-era hobos. So I went to the Pine Street Inn, which was actually an inn for the homeless in the Great Depression. And it was still on Pine Street and it was still happening. And I gave a speech at about midnight to these about 30 guys. And they're like, oh, this is great. A protest like the 60s. That's so cool. And they show up. And it was just amazing that everyone would get the soup and they go, oh, God bless you. And it was like so touching. And some people, the stockholders would give us a hard time. Others thought it was great. We're doing it. And I remember this one businessman comes by and he goes, wow, Reagan's only been in office 30 days and there's already soup lines in America. The homeless people are saying, there's no food for homeless people in Boston. You should do this every day. So that night when we're cleaning up all the equipment, we go, let's all give 2 weeks notice at our jobs and we'll do nothing but collect food, take it to public housing facilities or daycare centers and Rosie's Place, the battered women's shelter and stuff. And then in the afternoons, we'd cook and we would do street theater with meals at Harvard Square or at Park Station or Copley Square, places like that throughout Boston. And the other thing that we were doing, because there was going to be this giant protest in New York City on June 12, 1982, for nuclear disarmament, we would hold concerts and events and feed other people's events to build for that big protest. And that's how the first 2 years of Through Not Bombs was spent doing.
Raising money, as you just said, raising money for these very worthy causes is the hardest part of the job, because the people who are the most supportive of the cause are usually the people who have the least amount of money. So how have you been able to succeed all these years? We're talking decades now. We're talking, what,
45 years.
45 years. How have you been able to do that?
Well, I mean, so the thing that for me, I just had jobs and I had a graphic design company in Boston. And then I had a flyer distribution job I had my own where I posted posters in San Francisco when I moved there. That's how, I worked for Hallmark and I designed a drag queen magazine for a year in Kansas City, things like that. So that's how I paid my bills. And then, but to raise money was, we'd have punk concerts. A lot of the famous punk bands in the world, including Green Day, actually, when they signed a label, they donated money from their Oakland Coliseum concert because they had been recipients of our food in Berkeley at People's Park. Then they became cooks for Food Not Bombs, and then they became the Green Day that people know of today. But the trick of Food Not Bombs, so when the eight of us that started the group. We you know, I was working as a produce worker, and other people were in restaurant businesses or other things like that. And we had no money. So we had to come up with a strategy of how you could feed all these people all the time without money. And so recovering the food was the trick. So we had I got the produce from Bread and Circus after I gave my 2 weeks notice, and I got buckets of tofu delivered there from there were scraps that they couldn't sell. And we went to Haymarket. And so that became the model. We tried to do it where it was, in fact, the funny thing is the first 6 months we had rented this house from Joan Blount in Cambridge. And we were all excited about this, and we did pay the deposit and, you know, the first month's rent. But then we stopped paying. And then on the 6 months later, she takes us to lunch, and so we're like, oh, God, we're being evicted. And she said, no, the people of Cambridge love you. I go to these garden parties. You know, she was like a socialite. Her late husband had been the head of the French department at Harvard, and said, apparently 600 is too much. So what I'm going to do is lower it to 400. And just start paying next month. And so then I got the really great job at Passim's Coffee House, where I got to meet like Odetta and Joan Baez and all those people, because I was the sandwich maker there. And so, you know, that basically, and then, you know, we'd have like a little jar at the rallies when we'd serve food. That was actually probably our largest fundraisers, was bringing food to protests and good people just donating money to us. But we just never really, you know, we don't rely on money. So that was our trick. And that, I think, is part of the secret as to why it became a global movement and is in maybe 1,500 cities of the world right now. It's because poor people can do it without resources. And that's also part of the reason we're vegan and vegetarian, because we don't need all the fancy restaurant equipment to make the food safe. You know, it's much easier to have safe meals. And we've served like billions and billions of safe meals without any incident for the 45 years.
I want to talk about your work too, related to prisons and jails. Everybody who has served time in prison comes out and becomes in one way or another an activist about prison reform, the issues of prison reform and sentencing reform. I certainly have been. I write about it all the time. We should be ashamed of our carceral society, really, is what it is. We have draconian laws. There's a book that came out about 15 years ago by Dr. Harvey Silverglate, a professor of law at Harvard, called Three Felonies a Day. And he says in this book that we are so over-criminalized, so over-regulated in this country that the average person on the average day going about his or her normal business commits three felonies every single day. With the point being that if the government wants to get you, they're going to get you. And there's nothing that you can do to protect yourself. California has this draconian three strikes law, which I think may be in the process of being phased out now. It turns out that the three strikes law in California led to an increase in the murder rate, because if you have two felonies and then you're, you know, engaged in a third felony, people were deciding to shoot the witnesses and kill them. Because if you're going to go to prison life without parole anyway, you might as well try to get away with it by killing all the witnesses. It was exactly the opposite effect from what the state of California wanted. So tell us about the work you've done in this area of prisons, prison conditions, prison reform, and sentencing issues.
Yeah, so originally I was originally arrested in Portland, Oregon, just trying to park in front of my apartment when I had a job as the janitor at the Portland Art Museum, and I got beat up, and then I accidentally knocked over a police motorcycle, and then so I said, screw that, I'm going to crush both of them and try to go to Washington State, but I missed the exit and ended up in spending a week in jail, and finally getting my uncle found me and bailed me out. But then in San Francisco, we started getting arrested. And I was arrested on August 15th, 1988, was the first arrest for sharing free food. We were told you could get a permit. I applied for a permit. There wasn't a permit. We got started getting arrested. So in San Francisco, I was that's where I was arrested 94 times, technically, for serving food without a permit. And I eventually, there was over 1,000 arrests of Food Not Bombs volunteers from 1988 to 1995. And then we were very much in the culture of the local, both the sixth floor of 850 Bryant Street. And then when you got your felony arrest, you'd be on the seventh floor. And I got put in the San Bruno. I did a North County Alameda, which is a panopticon. And that was a nightmare. And I was there like waiting on my three strikes trial. So I got framed on the three strikes. I was first person to get all three, first white person to get all three strikes. My first one, I was assaulted by the mayor's film commissioner in City Hall. I got assault, battery, strong-arm robbery. In that case, they claimed I stole a $99 beeper, the evidence of which was that he went out and bought a $99 beeper. They never found a beeper on me or in City Hall. Then the second one, I was handing out the correspondence from Amnesty International to the Board of Supervisors on the second floor. And one of the politician's aides, Nancy Kitsch, slammed her door on my friend as he and I were leaving, and I put my hand out to stop it. My hand ended up going through part of the glass, and then I ended up getting arrested for assault with an intent to kill, the glass apparently going into her neck. And then my third strike was possession of stolen property related to the beepers, which was every day since we got arrested. We would go to this vegetarian restaurant on Market Street and get their milk crate, set them up as our tables. And then at the end of the day, if the police hadn't taken them, we would take them back. Well, they said I stole 24 Berkeley Farm Dairy milk crates. So that was my third strike. And eventually I end up pleading out for assault, battery, strong arm robbery, because they were bringing riot police into the courtroom every time, and we couldn't get them to stop doing that. And it looked like the government was just going to railroad me into life in prison. So and then I just went on these tours basically for much rest of my life to stay out, well, at least to stay out of San Francisco, because I didn't want my parole thing. But then also during this whole time, the homeless were being arrested for just being homeless. So one Thanksgiving in 1992, we decided that we would show a video on squatting in Europe at this like place in the Tenderloin. And somebody that came there had actually talked to a person who was renting this or going to try to sell a AAA movie theater, but the top floor was all empty. And he had the key because nobody would go in that, you know, the realtor wouldn't go in the neighborhood. So we opened that building up and we moved a bunch of families into that for Christmas. About 2 days before Thanksgiving. And then there was a building across from the, an abandoned building directly across from the main soup kitchen, Glide Memorial Church, where the mayor would come to cut turkey on Thanksgiving. And yeah, he's like arresting homeless and arresting us and everything. So when he arrived, we hung banners out the windows saying, "Homes, not jails." This was actually, all these abandoned buildings in San Francisco were as a result of the savings and loan crisis. And so we would write down the addresses of the abandoned buildings, go to the tax office. And if there's like, you know, sometimes 20, 30 mortgage companies would own that building. So then we would go and we'd take off their lock, put our lock on it. And then at lunch or dinner at Food Not Bonds, we would tell people, "Hey, meet us tomorrow at 9 o'clock at this address and we'll give you a free place to live." And we would turn on the water. We'd give them a lease so they could get the electricity turned on, or we would turn on the electricity ourselves. And according to the book No Trespassing by Andre Kars, we had people living in 100 buildings at any given time, and we had keys to hanging on a wall at the San Francisco Tenants Union of 400 buildings that we had access to. And so we did that for quite a number of years, and it kind of spread to other cities. And it certainly would be something to do right now again with the crisis is occurring. I had one other thing about the amount of time, you know, being 500 days in the in and out of the jails there. We have a toll-free number, 1-800-884-1136. And in those days, you could call out two toll-free numbers. And so what we would do, because we were there so much, so all, you know, we felt we were in that jail all the time for 8 years. So what we would do is we would write the toll-free number above every payphone in every cell block of about 24 people. And then we'd also write the voicemail code on the underneath it. So then the families outside could leave a message on our toll-free number, and then the inmates could call in and leave a message for their families. And we did that until they abandoned the ability to do toll-free numbers from jails. So we were real heroes amongst the poor in San Francisco.
And right now, you are in Mexico. Tell us what you're doing in Mexico.
Well, I'm going around on a tour, speaking to Food Not Bombs groups and helping them cook and serve. But also what had happened was my girlfriend, who spent 6 years in the Civil War as a human rights worker in El Salvador, noticed that the police were spending a lot of time parking outside our house. So then there is a situation in where a bunch of young kids went to a ICE detention center in Texas, and they launched off fireworks on the 4th of July, and they did graffiti. Apparently, somebody not connected to them also showed up, and they fired at one of the cops. They got arrested, and so there's 17 of them, and two of the people have been charged under this new national presidential finding 7 as a, it's not really legally a terrorism increased thing yet. I don't even know really in the law how this is going to be interpreted, but then anyway, it's part of the let's blow everyone's mind type of thing of the Trump administration. And then there's all this talk about, you know, Antifa and anarchists, and we must crush them and everything. And then And Trump talks about that case, like at the Antifa roundtable and these things like that. And so then the other thing that had occurred is Fox TV, what's his name? Jesse Waters, I think that was his name. He's interviewing a fake Antifa person named Eric. And he goes, well, how did you get started with Antifa? And so, well, we were in ARA. Most people don't know that was probably it's called Anti-Racist Action. And Food Not Bombs, and we go to punk shows, you know, and that's how I got involved. And said, well, we really like being violent and everything, and we even have the anarchist cookbook, and I wrote the anarchist cookbook. So, so there's this whole thing going on, and then there's this whole another Turning Point USA gave a presentation at the Antifa roundtable about how they're claiming that the homeless industrial complex is paying Antifa and anarchists to do Stop the Sweep protests. Well, we've been doing Stop the Sweep protests all the time outside the main shelter in Santa Cruz where I live, because the shelter and the city are sweeping the streets of all the homeless. They've received a $4.5 million encampment abatement grant from the state of California to get rid of homeless people. And that's one of the places that we, you know, when in the middle of the week, we go by every day and give them food and we give them tents and things like that, separate from our weekly meal at the town clock every Saturday and Sunday. And they get scattered into the wind and you can't find them and give them food. So, and the fact that we ended up in a Public Records Act request, getting the email correspondence bragging about this with the city by the shelter. So it's this. So now that's now on Fox TV all the time about how the homeless shelters are paying the anarchists to do these Stop the Sweep protests. And I made this big banner that said Stop the Sweeps. And so my girlfriend suggested I leave the United States for a while. And I have tons of friends all over Mexico, so it's not a problem. I've traveled Mexico. Even as a little kid, I used to play in Mexico across the Rio Grande in the third grade because all my friends were Mexican and I lived on the border. But I'm just sort of waiting to see what happens with this whole like hoopla. And it's like a clown show. It's so ridiculous in a way, it's hard to take it seriously. But it's also, I'm not really, I don't want to take a lot of chances by happen to be in the United States at the wrong time, in the wrong place. And also the locals I'm friends, actually, oddly enough, with the chief of police of Santa Cruz. He's a really good guy, Bernie Esquani. But the people that run Santa Cruz, California, are also the deep state. So the highest ranking person at Meta is lives in you know, is the husband of the person that owns Bookshop Santa Cruz. Her brother is the person that started predictive policing and the software that is now being used by Palantir. So they don't like me. I've been banned from their bookstore. So I thought, well, the coordination between, would not be unlikely to have some trouble for all these things. So she packed my bags, gave me disguises, all these things, said, get the heck out of here. And unfortunately, my best friend had passed away on October 2nd. My main person of Thu Nap Bom, Joy Benet. And then as soon as we finished our memorial service on October 6th, and I just came to visit all my friends in Mexico, and I just going around the country. And it's so inspiring. It's amazing that the Thu Nap Bom activists down here are like, wow, both the cooking and the serving and giving the presentations. It just, the love. I mean, I was walking through a plaza and this person goes, oh, Keith, what are you doing here? I haven't seen you in 14 years. You know, it's like really, oh my God. It's like, it's just very joyous to be traveling around Mexico, hanging out with the Thu Nap Bom's kids and serving food. It's just couldn't be more wonderful.
Before we started recording, you and I were talking about the current situation between the United States and Mexico. The Trump administration now famously declared the Mexican drug cartels to be terrorist organizations. I thought at the time that he did that was simply a paperwork exercise that would free up money that Congress had already appropriated for counterterrorism to allow, for example, the interception of communications emanating from the cartels. I think I seriously underestimated the Trump administration's plans. Now it looks as though this was done as, to lay the groundwork for an attack on the cartels. I'm not really sure what that would even look like. What are you hearing in Mexico? Are people worried about these announcements coming out of Washington?
They're not specifically worried. So a lot of the people I'm hanging out with are saying, well, half the cartels are connected to the government. And the other, and this potentially will be useful to the government to get rid of the competition. And so a lot of it is that. But I have an experience of being in one of my tours 14 years ago. I was traveling northern Mexico, and I would give a presentation. And there'd always be these two men that would stand next to me in dark khaki pants and a polo shirt and sunglasses with their arms crossed. And the audience would ask, who are these people? And I'd say, I have no idea. And it gave a huge amount of credibility to the movement in Mexico that there would be these two people that look very clearly law enforcement. And then I had suffered from fibromyalgia for many, many years. And I was trying to get disability. And the disability judge, though my lawyer, the CIA had spoken to them, and I traveled all over northern Mexico. So if I could do that, then I was not really all that disabled. And she gave me an option, like I could either do 5 years in prison for fraud, or I could just drop my disability case, which, of course, I dropped my disability case. And I'm very blessed that I did, because I recovered. I did a water-only fast for 23 days, and it cured me of fibromyalgia, and I've been completely healthy ever since, which is since 2013. So I've had problems in Europe with Interpol. In fact, I accidentally took an Interpol agent on a 60-day tour of North America with two other people from Spain, and it was a very weird experience. But the Thu Nap Bom has been under a massive amount of surveillance for the whole time by the FBI. In fact, we were on August 22nd, 1988, two FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force individuals observed the arrest at Golden Gate Park, and they filed a memo to the FBI field office saying that we were a credible national security threat. At that time, there were 30 Thu Nap Bom activists, about 10 in Long Beach, California, 10 in San Francisco, and 10 in Boston. in 2009, I happened to watch a C-SPAN lecture by a State Department official comparing us to Al-Qaeda and who was more dangerous. And they said that we were much more dangerous because we were might convince the American public the money should be diverted from military spending to healthcare, education, and other social services. And therefore, there would be not be enough money to fight Al-Qaeda.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I don't even know what to say to that. It's so absurd.
The whole thing's crazy. And so that, and then, you know, I've like, there's been incredible frame-ups. Like, for instance, the Funabombs kids cooking at Occupy Cleveland. There was five people were sentenced to 10 years in prison. Three of them were Funabombs volunteers from Cleveland Funabombs. And the federal complaint outlines how they do. It's like actually totally educational to see how they set it up, because they sent a person that was trying to avoid a prison time to pretend like he was this radical black activist, and then he just strung them along, and they gave them the anarchist cookbook with the C4 circled, which is why I rewrote the anarchist cookbook. And because in the federal complaint, it has the anarchist cookbook in it, I think written, described five or six times in a five-page document. And I just like, we've got to dilute the anarchist cookbook with a real anarchist cookbook about anarchism. And I wrote to William Powell, the first author, and he said, yeah, well, I would love to have that diluted. And I said, can I use your denunciation on Amazon for the preface of my book? And he said, go for it. And so I did. And it does have actually vegan recipes for a family of six or for groups of 100. But it also has information on the philosophy of nonviolent direct action and what anarchism really is, which is what I think right now will ultimately be one of the more important features of survival under the Trump administration, even though they're trying to clamp down on us, because with cutting food stamps on November 1st, and who knows what the poverty, I mean, already we're way overwhelmed with people coming to eat. And, you know, under the Biden administration, I started receiving between 10 to 20 phone calls a day, not my toll-free number, from seniors who had, as a way of getting them to do the Part B of the Obamacare process, they would be given by an insurance company a $100 gift card, but they'd assume that the $100 came every month. The insurance company would give my phone number, and I heard for 3 years the most heartbreaking stories of seniors. They're eating cat food, haven't eaten in 4 days. All they've got is cornflakes. Please come. We're cutting our insulin in half. These stories were so heartbreaking. And I felt blessed that I had these conversations. And I was actually recovering from a back injury. So it was kind of couldn't go out and do as much Funabombs as I traditionally would do. And it was just a beautiful but also sad experience. And now with food stamps cuts, you know, it's just heartbreaking. But a thing like Food Not Bombs and mutual aid types of things, I think are going to be super valuable. You know, and we are in, like I say, 1,000. I've had like seven new chapters start in last two days. And it's because I'm the guy that updates the map on the Food Not Bombs website, foodnotbombs.net. And their stories are really inspiring too. These people are excited to feed people. And I just think that, it's going to be, on one hand, so tragic, but on the other hand, it's really bringing grassroots people together to really solve, you know, our community's issues and our communities, you know, get to what really people need: food, water, clothing, shelter, culture, community. And this whole Trump thing is quite the opposite of all that. So it's just an amazing time to be. I think this is, in a certain weird sense, the golden time of Food Not Bombs.
Wow. I want to ask you about the state of activism in the United States. Just in the last year, we've watched dramatic events unfold outside of Atlanta at something called Cop City, where activists were opened fire upon. They were arrested, charged with attempted murder, people facing life without parole. just for setting up tents in the woods to try to stop a police training center from being built. Peaceful protest. In Oklahoma, a young man and young woman went to the headquarters of an oil company. They went onto a walkway overlooking the entrance to this oil company. They unfurled a banner, an anti-oil banner, and threw glitter. They were charged with terrorism, and they face life without parole in a prison in Oklahoma. The federal government and some state governments are coming down like a ton of bricks on peaceful protesters. Peaceful protesters where protest is guaranteed in the Constitution. What's the future look like? Is this going to turn around? Or if it's not going to turn around, what can protesters do to ensure their rights?
Well, this is really pretty shocking. So in Santa Cruz, the students at the University of California, Santa Cruz, they did an encampment just like they did all about the Palestinian issue. And they were brutally repressed by the University of California police. And there's still a group of people that are facing felony charges that are still to this day. I think even this week, there's going to be another, there's a call to go to their court appearance and so on. And so there's that is happening, repression against Palestinian protesters, just like is happening in England and other places. If that is getting really draconian, and then I knew Manny at Cop City. He was a Tallahassee Food Not Bombs activist, and during COVID, I was on Zoom calls with him and the other Tallahassee kids, and he's the one that got 57 bullets in his body while sitting cross-legged in a tree trying to stop Cop City in Atlanta. So then about a week ago in Oakland, there was a blockade of the causeway to Alameda where the ICE was staging to go and start rousting people, immigrants and what's turning out to be not even immigrants anymore, undocumented workers, just random people on the streets. And they shot live ammo at the protesters. Thing was that the person was backing up, U-Haul to block the causeway. And they've done that kind of stuff like in past, but, there'd be tear gas and maybe rubber bullets, but to shoot live ammo with semi-automatic weapons, that's a new twist and what's going on. So it does seem very dangerous, but at the same point, really important to get out on the streets and to be protesting. But it's very difficult to know how effective that will be. So I have a Substack, Anarchist Cooked Up Substack, and then a WordPress Anarchist Cooked Up blog, and I talk about these things in the Joy of Anti-Fascism, Community is the Cure. And so I think we're kind of going to be like medieval monks or something. We're going to end up in a situation where because the cuts in food stamps, the AI, now, like several people have been arrested, just regular citizens, where AI said they were criminal. And there was a young black man in Baltimore like a couple of days ago where they were sure he had a gun. And when the cops got there, it was a bag of Doritos. But this is happening more and more. And, Palantir, Joe Lansdale, for instance, he started a thing called Cicero Institute, which is a very aggressive campaign to criminalize the homeless. And it's actually technically illegal to be homeless in the United States right now. Yet there's no. And so what they seem to be doing is building concentration camps or what they call navigation centers and moving the homeless out of the cities. And then the Trump administration is indicting people running the homeless services for fraud, which those of us that live and breathe in the homeless community are kind of like, yeah, that's great. They should be arrested for fraud. But what that seems to signal to me is that they're going to start federalizing the homeless services in these prison camps and start moving. Because when you have 42 million Americans not having food stamps, at the prime time when you're supposed to be buying Christmas presents and getting ready for Thanksgiving and all that, the poverty is going to be immense. And is the theory to create like so much social unrest that there's going to be a demand by the good citizens to be harsh and clamp down? So I think there's a combination, you know, so there's this attack, against every kind of minority. Right now, it's the focus is on undocumented people and homeless people and protesters, anarchists, and whatever they're calling, you know, these vague definitions like anti-Christian people and the anti-capitalist people and stuff like that. And then it will potentially move into, and certainly there'll be like, and, you know, clamp down on gay, lesbian, and trans people. There'll be that massive thing going on. And so it is a very, very scary time. And it's interesting because I've been writing that we should get in affinity groups like we were when we were doing anti-nuclear work and anti-militarism work in the 70s and the 80s. And to build like community and so on. And then all of a sudden the Trump administration is going, we're going to crush the affinity groups. I had no idea that these people had ever even heard of an affinity group. You know, in fact, most young people had never heard of it. That's like old school activist back, time. So, but I just, even with that, caveat of the Trump administration claiming they're going to crush it. Now, how effective they're going to be and all these things, they're, seemed like they just hire random people off the streets, hand them AR-15s and give them flak jackets and make them deputize them as ICE guys. And
that's the what other they do in the prison system. The only thing you need, I'll tell you exactly what you need to become a prison guard in the United States. You need a GED or to be working on a GED and no felony convictions. And that's it. Exactly. When I was in prison, there are two points I want to make. When I was in prison, the guards were supposed to do mail call every day. Usually, a prisoner did mail call. Why? Because the guard couldn't read. He literally couldn't read. And so he couldn't pass out the mail because he couldn't read the names, number one. Number two, the last of my cellmates to move into my cell before I left was a homeless guy from Pittsburgh. He had some stupid federal conviction, whatever it was, and he was out on parole, whatever it is, probation, parole, whatever. The federal government doesn't have parole. He was on probation. So it gets cold in Pittsburgh, and he was living in a tent along the Ohio River. So he purposely violated his probation so that he would get locked up again on purpose, so that he could spend the winter indoors.
I've been locked up with a lot of people like that.
Yeah, a lot of people like that.
A lot of people
do that. I remember being flabbergasted by it at the time. And then coming to understand it was actually quite common. That's what
people I was in a cell with a guy that said, well, when I get out, I'm going over to Marin because I'm going to do the specific crime because I know it'll get me through the whole winter. And that jail is much nicer. You hear this all the time. So much of the inmates are people trying to avoid freezing to death.
Yeah. And you get three meals a day. You get emergency medical care if you happen to need it, free medication. Yeah. And you get to sleep in a bunk, that's not in the rain or in the snow or getting rousted by the cops.
Yeah. We have a system the other thing, of course, when you get out, if you have support system is whoever you were with when you got arrested, right? Then you got to make a living. You don't leave with any money, or if you're lucky, you leave with $250. And then you got to start your life over. So it just kind of reinforces the idea that you should start selling commodities again. And commodities being now fentanyl and meth. In the old days, it was heroin and meth, but now there's not really any heroin anymore because of the Afghan war ending. So, it's a crazy system. It's like completely bonkers. And now with the food, it's very likely with the cuts in food stamps, so a huge percentage of people on food stamps work. Many work two jobs. Many, like Walmart workers, they get signed up for food stamps when when they are signing in for their job. And Walmart makes billions of dollars off of food stamps, not only in the savings of not paying their employees enough, but then those same employees buy the food at Walmart. So people are going to be so desperate to survive. There's going to be a lot more shoplifting. There's going to be a lot. It could get to the point where there'll be food riots. And we've had food riots back in San Francisco. And it's a food riot is a whole nother story than any other kind of riot, because these are people that are so desperate. They will stop at nothing to get food. And during COVID in Santa Cruz, that we were the only food for homeless people for 3 years, because the other kitchens were indoors and they had to be shut. And so like in the first week, there were these two guys with a rock about to break out a window of a restaurant to get some food. And one of our volunteers was walking by and said, "Oh, don't do that. Just go down and eat with us." So we actually, instead of being pariahs that we are in Santa Cruz, we should be like honored, because Trader Joe's and Safeway and CVS and all that would have been robbed within like a month, had it not been for, but not only just shoplifted, there wouldn't have been anything on the shelves that was edible if it had not been for us. Now, I have activist friends that say, well, you shouldn't have done that, so there would be riots and they would overthrow the government, blah, blah, blah. But that's not our interest. We, don't want the people that we love that live out on the streets to be getting hurt. Yeah, I've been to riots. I was at the Rodney King riot. I was like actually very badly injured at that by the police. And I was at the, Martin Luther King riot in Philadelphia and Germantown. So I've seen riots, and I'm not really excited about there being riots. And, and I don't think that they're necessarily the most effective way of political change, quite frankly. Essentially, it just brings the heat down on you. And that's why there's a lot of agent provocateurs in it, to get the buildings burning and stuff. So there's an excuse. And right now we're in a pivotal point in U.S. history where that's very likely to happen. And the repression is very likely to be brutal.
Couldn't agree more. Keith, before we let you go, tell our viewers where they can find out more about your work. Tell us again the website and what can people do to be helpful?
Yeah, so our website is foodnotbombs.net, and that's where you can get our email address, menu@foodnotbombs.net. And that's where you can get our toll-free number, 1-800-884-1136. And which was donated to me actually by a Clamshell Alliance friend when I was facing 25 to life. And I've had it ever since 1994. So it's like a blessing. And then the things that right now, the main thing is to volunteer with Food Not Bombs in your local community, or start at Food Not Bombs. And if you're not within your ability, then you can donate money at foodnotbombs.net. And then we distribute that amongst the chapters around the world. Recently, we've been actually paying for some earthquake relief in the Philippines. And a few months before that, we were paying for the volcano relief in the Philippines. And so that, and then we're probably likely with this hurricane happening in the Atlantic, whatever we can do to help with the Food Not Bombs chapters in the Caribbean. And so that's what, largely it goes to really the desperation of the United States. In fact, we're trying to get a refrigerator from one chapter now and things like that. So you can donate money at foodnotbombs.net. You can buy the Anarchist Cookbook if you want to get in a lot of trouble. Boy, sales have really spiked since Trump got in the office. Or you can get a startup kit online and get your banner and buttons and a book, Hungry for Peace, so you know how to do Food Not Bombs. But the reality is you can download all that as PDFs. If you have no money, just read my book for free at foodnotbombs.net. Both of them, they're PDFs. You can print them out. We're not about trying to make money. Nothing's copywritten. You can steal all of our logos and artwork. I designed the logo. Many of those paintings are mine online. Steal it all and go out there and feed people. That's what you can do.
Keith McHenry, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, John. So an honor to be with you.
This was a real treat for me. Thank you so much.
I'm going to cry. Thank you.
And ladies and gentlemen, please do me that favor of liking, sharing, telling your friends about us, and signing up as a subscriber. It's free, and it really helps us on that algorithm. I'm John Kiriakou. You've been listening to Deep Focus. Come back next time. We'll see you then.